Today is Tuesday, July 3rd. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. Secretary of State is heading back to North Korea as new intelligence shows it hasn't stopped its nuclear program.
These conversations are continuing to evolve. I'm not going to get into the details, but I can tell you that progress continues to be made.
A Thai youth soccer team has been found alive after 9 days in a cave. The president's former attorney is in serious legal hot water and may now be ready to talk to prosecutors. Also ahead, good news for coffee drinkers. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, as the White House continues to tout progress with North Korea, satellite imagery and U.S. intelligence officials contradict that assertion, revealing evidence of recent work at multiple secret sites in North Korea connected to the country's production of enriched uranium for nuclear weapons. North Korea also appears to be finishing an expansion of a ballistic missile construction site. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo will make a third trip to Pyongyang this week. At Monday's briefing to reporters, White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders declined to discuss the reports.
We aren't going to confirm or deny any intelligence reports. What I can tell you is that we're continuing to make progress. Ambassador Kim had a meeting just yesterday with members of the North Korean delegation, and Secretary Pompeo, as I just mentioned, will be headed to North Korea later this week, and we're going to continue those conversations.
Trump recently declared there is no longer a nuclear threat from Pyongyang due to his great success negotiating with North Korea's leader. A number of experts are questioning the timetable and willingness of North Korea to cooperate with its pledge to denuclearize following last month's historic summit in Singapore between President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. NBC News, quoting U.S. officials, says the North has increased production of fuel for nuclear weapons, while the Washington Post reported U.S. intelligence officials don't believe the North intends to give up its nuclear arsenal. Joshua Pollack, a senior research associate at the Middlebury Institute for International Studies, tells VOA's Victor Beatty, theoretically a lot of work can be done in a year's time, but the hard part will be the politics of disarmament.
Negotiating anything with the North Koreans takes a very long time. For example, the six-party talks, which was in the 2000s, opened in mid-2003, and the first agreement with real commitments in it took about 2 years to arrive. The first agreement on how to implement those commitments took another roughly 2 years. It simply seems to me that the pace of diplomacy with the North Koreans is never that quick. And while bulldozers and container ships and whatever else you could imagine can certainly do a lot of work in that time, the path won't be open for that, politically speaking, quite so quickly. And I think talking about a year, 1 year, is setting unrealistic expectations.
So U.S. intelligence apparently is not certain exactly how many nuclear warheads that the North has. The Defense Intelligence Agency says it may be as high of about 50. Obviously, the number will involve time to get rid of them.
Yes, I don't think that the North Koreans will ever let us know exactly how many they have or really plan to give them up. They have given a declaration of past fissile material production more than once, and I think that they are determined not to show their hand fully. They are interested, I think, in lowering the profile of their nuclear program, but they will not give the whole thing up. It's too important to them as a means of security against a vastly more powerful opponent. Having said that, there are precedents for understanding and trying to verify past fissile material production, that is plutonium and highly enriched uranium that you would put in weapons. And becoming confident of what a state tells you takes years. There's a long process of examining records forensically to make sure they haven't been falsified, visiting facilities, taking samples, checking the samples against the declarations, trying to figure out how much has gone missing because of industrial processes and how much might have been diverted. This is not simple. So again, logistics and earth moving is easy enough. It's quick enough. But this larger process of verification is much tougher. Not that I imagine it will really come into play in this case. The trust between the two sides is persistently low. And while the North Koreans may give up some facilities to us as a goodwill gesture, I do not believe they will ever give up their nuclear weapons.
Well, joining us now is someone with a unique perspective as well on the situation, 90-year-old Korean War veteran Leonard Adrian, who was a Marine medic, who witnessed some of the worst of the Korean War's carnage and some of the most iconic battles. So I understand you didn't talk about the experience at all until very recently. Tell us why.
When I left Korea, I had orders to go to Maesan, which was the headquarters of the 1st Marine Division. We were at the 38th parallel where I was stationed. And it was an early, early morning copter flight. And I was standing alone in this icy wind blowing from the north. And I was waiting for the copter about 5 in the morning. And the copter pad, which was a rice paddy, filled up with the members of my platoon. Mm-hmm. They all came to say goodbye. And in the conversations that we had, along with the hugs and the handshakes, we all agreed that we would put Korea behind us. We would move into the future. We would forget what we had experienced. And we did not exchange addresses or phone numbers or names or anything. And that kind of began it. When I got home, I believed that the best thing for me was to move into the future, create a career for myself. So I did not talk about it to anyone, including my wife, who I married the year after I got back from Korea for over 60 years.
Do you ever regret not keeping in touch with any of those people?
Yes, I do. I think it would have been kind of interesting for me to know what happened to them, how many of them came back. It was a very traumatically sad moment for me because I knew that some of them would never come home, and some would come home without an eye or a leg or an arm or a serious injury that would impede their future. And I saw those waving hands, and it was sad that I was leaving, and they were there, and many of them were going to be traumatized by the continuing war. So I would have liked to have known who came home, who didn't.
I imagine it was a pretty bloody, ugly situation.
The Korean War was very brutal, very bloody, and we were fighting on the hillsides. And if you've seen some of the television beyond the 38th parallel, you can see that it's a very rough, hilly, difficult terrain. And our job was to go up those hills against the Chinese or the North Koreans who were on top of the hill holding the high ground. And our job was to take the high ground. We had to fight our way up beyond their machine guns, beyond their burp guns, through their mortars, through their artillery, and secure the hilltop. And then we tried to hold the hilltop. And this went on and on and on for years before they finally had a ceasefire on July 27, 1953.
And now, of course, you have a memoir out that talks about your experience, and I imagine you've been doing a lot of thinking about your history, given what's been happening with this latest summit, pretty historic, with President Trump and Kim Jong-un. What did you think of that summit?
It was just the beginning, but I think there is reason to hope that there will be an agreement reached that is good for everybody, for North Korea, South Korea, the United States, and the world. And the reason I think it's possible is because there should be strong motivation on behalf of North Korea. Kim Jong-un is interested in survival. And short of making an agreement, if he were to continue, in my opinion, to develop the intercontinental missiles which he's already got, and the nuclear warheads that he can then attach and control them and aim them and send them, that is an impossible thing, I think, for the United States and Japan particularly to live under that threat of multiple warheads coming at our property.
What do you think needs to happen?
I think the best thing that could happen is that President Trump and Kim Jong-un make an agreement, and the agreement is he denuclearizes the peninsula in exchange for lifting the sanctions and a guarantee of his safety, that the United States and China would protect him against any attack from anywhere, and if the United States, through economic help, plus the removal of all sanctions, would help him build an economic secure country. That's great motivation for him. We have motivation, of course, because we'd like to see put an end to this nuclear threat in the hands of a dictator who may not be reliable.
You're the author of the memoir Hilltop Doc, a Marine Corpsman fighting through the mud and blood of the Korean War. What do you hope people will take away from this as the main essence of this book?
I hope that they will read the book and understand what war is really like. Not the John Wayne movie version of heroics of war. My book is realistic. It tells what happened to me as a corpsman with the Marines on those hillsides. And although I don't think it's a depressing book, it doesn't pull any punches. In fact, the chancellor of Washington University, who encouraged me to complete the book, told me that he wanted the world to have a realistic book about what war is like, what the conditions are like, and get a realistic picture of the horrors and the terror of war and how war is the worst alternative to solve problems between peoples and nations.
All right. Well, we appreciate your talking about it. Marine Corps Korean War veteran and author of the memoir Hilltop Doc, Leonard Adrian, thank you for sharing your story. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The EU is warning the U.S. against car tariffs. Trump met Monday with four Supreme Court candidates. Iranian diplomat is among six arrested in Europe over alleged bomb plot. And disabled Mosul residents are struggling with life in a destroyed city. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. A team of elite Thai Navy divers has reached a critical passage in a flooded Thailand cave complex where 12 teenage football players and their coach have been trapped for 9 days. As we hear in this tape, rescuers are now communicating with them.
Yeah, bless your hand.
Thank you.
No, thank you.
How many of you?
13. Yeah, 13.
Brilliant.
Backpack,
is
we go inside?
No, not today.
Not
today. There's two of us. You have to die. We are coming. It's okay.
It's okay.
Many people are coming.
Many, many people.
We are the first. Many people come.
What day?
Tomorrow.
No, what day is it? No, I'm kidding.
Monday.
Okay, but 1 week and Monday. You have been here 10 days. 10 days. You are very strong. Very strong.
Officials say the divers reached a juncture inside the caves in the northern province of Chiang Rai early Monday, where the passageway split in two directions. The team had been missing since June 23rd when they didn't return to their homes from practice. The only trace of them had been bicycles and athletic footwear found outside the entrance of the complex and handprints along the cave walls. Heavy flooding brought on by days of heavy rains have hampered the divers' efforts to reach the team. International experts from the U.S., Australia, China, and Britain have assisted in the search and rescue efforts. Reporter Steve Sanford is on scene, and he's bringing us the latest details.
Ongoing mountain runoffs from the daily rains in the caverns of Tam Luang Cave have hampered rescue efforts. The U.S. Pacific Command has arrived to help, exploring all possible options for the quickest extraction of those trapped.
The rain is unpredictable, but then you also have the human element, 24-hour operations. It's amazing to see, you know, the Thai authorities coming together and all the volunteers here supporting the rescue operation.
The relief area has grown with each day as volunteers cook meals and offer supplies to the growing crowds.
I want to give energy and support for the rescue teams that are going inside the caves since I can't go in and help them myself.
But the urgency of draining the water using high-voltage pumps has brought with it injuries for some of the inexperienced workers. It's a stressful time for all coming to grasp with the crisis, including local teacher Churchu Pompanya, who taught six of the students.
At school, we're letting the students meditate and pray and giving each other support for the missing students.
As the nation digs in to help, the hope for a successful rescue remains in the hearts of the people. Steve Sanford for VOA News in Chiang Rai, Thailand.
President Donald Trump's one-time lawyer, Michael Cohen, now under investigation, criminal investigation, said Monday that his first priority is to protect his family and country and not the president. Cohen, a New York attorney, once described himself as the guy who would take a bullet for Trump, the real estate mogul turned politician. But now that special counsel Robert Mueller is investigating Cohen's role during Trump's 2016 presidential campaign and New York prosecutors are probing Cohen's business deals, he's taking a much different approach, as revealed in an interview with ABC News. The 51-year-old lawyer signaling his willingness to cooperate with prosecutors, saying his first loyalty will always go to his wife and children and then his country. Until recently, he had played a key role in representing Trump, although not in any formal role in the White House. Joining us to talk about the change in strategy is criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. What did you take away from Cohen's interview?
Well, it's very clear that Michael Cohen is shifting, that Michael Cohen has decided that there was a time when he was the fixer, he was the bulldog, and he was the guy who would take a bullet. Well, that has changed. He has decided that Michael Cohen is about Michael Cohen now, and that is a fundamental shift for this man.
Why do you think he did this interview and said the things he did? Do you think he's trying to send a signal to the White House, to the president, that maybe he's hoping he'll get a pardon? Or do you think it's to prosecutors in hopes of cutting a deal? Or why would he do something like this, an interview like this?
Well, that's very interesting. As a criminal defense attorney, I thought to myself, I wouldn't want my client talking to ABC News. So I've been thinking about that issue. It could go one of two directions. He may be trying to drive the president, although it seems clear that the president and the president's team has already jettisoned Michael Cohen, and they have already tried to undercut Michael Cohen. That's very, very clear. And that seems to have created a lot of anger inside of the Cohen camp. And so that's a big part of this. At the same time, it seems very clear that what Michael Cohen is doing is he is trying to reach out not just to the New York prosecutors in Manhattan, but reaching out and providing accolades to the Bureau, accolades to Bob Mueller, accolades to the investigation itself, and even hitting back on the Russians. And that's very inconsistent with what Donald Trump is doing. So I actually think that Michael Cohen is turning to the prosecutors, coming to him with his hands open, saying, I am prepared, I want to cooperate, I want to help. That seems to be what he's doing right now.
The feds have about 1.3 million documents they seized of Cohen's. I imagine that would definitely encourage him to stop his loyalty to President Trump and maybe lean more toward his family and, as he said, his country.
I think Michael Cohen is leaning away from a jail cell. That's what he's doing right now. He's trying to avoid sitting in a concrete box, because if you look at what is already out there, the investigation that's taking place in Manhattan, the investigation that's taking place in Washington, D.C., and in Northern Virginia by Mueller and his team, it appears that Michael Cohen is facing a lot. And he may have a lot of information, and that may be important that he take advantage at the most opportune time to use that to his benefit. That's the reason he brought in his new defense attorney. That's the reason he seems to be shifting right now.
He is potentially in a lot of legal trouble, given that he's willing to turn against someone he seemed to have unflailing loyalty to, that meaning the president, saying he would take a bullet for Mr. Trump. Do you think that he has knowledge that could be beneficial enough to prosecutors that they would be willing to make a deal with him, and that he might actually, that might cause the president some problems?
Yes, I do. And the reason I do is because it appears that Michael Cohen was the president's bad man. Michael Cohen was the conduit in many, many ways. If there was dirty work that needed to be done, we can look back at his work as a lawyer. Frequently, some of the things that he was already publicly involved in, he was the bad guy. He was the guy who took care of those things. If that extended into the campaign in any sense of the word, if that extended into some of the behavior with President Trump when he was simply Donald Trump's citizen trying to get in and work in Russia, it could have been Michael Cohen who was part of that conduit. And what he might also know is the inner workings, the connections between Donald Trump, his son, other members of the family, other advisors who are close to the president. It appears that Michael Cohen was very close, very involved in terms of those issues. And all of that information could certainly go into the hands of Bob Mueller and other prosecutors. This could be a very real headache for the president.
All right. Criminal defense attorney Jack Rice, we appreciate it as always. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Sporty greetings to all our VOA listeners. This is Sonny Young, host of The Sunny Side of Sports.
We will rock you.
Please join me at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC, Monday through Friday, for special World Cup updates during the month-long football festival in Russia. Right here on The Voice of America.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, Managing Editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
VOA's International Edition continues. A new tax on social media has taken effect in Uganda, angering many who see the revenue measure as an attack on free speech. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
The tax on users of sites such as Facebook was first proposed by longtime leader Yoweri Museveni, who complained of online gossip in a March letter that urged the finance minister to raise money to cope with the consequences. In addition to the usual data fees, social media users now in Uganda must pay the equivalent of a nickel a day to access all media websites. The tax will be deducted by service providers, who will then pass on money to the Government Revenue Service. Many Ugandans are bitter, a prominent human rights lawyer says, believing the tax is anti-people, anti-social, and not development-oriented. I'm Charles Ledesma.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA's Cassini mission, which provided a close look of Saturn, its moons, and famous rings for 13 years, came to a blazing end on September 11, 2017. One of the highlights of the Cassini mission was the 2014 discovery of geysers spewing jets of icy water high above Saturn's moon Enceladus. A team of scientists led by the University of Heidelberg, Germany, studied data gathered by Cassini and identified fragments of large, complex organic molecules containing hundreds of atoms originating from Saturn's icy moon. Cassini had previously detected smaller, more common organic molecules at Enceladus. The scientists say the existence of these large complex molecules, along with hydrothermal activity on the moon, supports a theory that a massive liquid water ocean below the icy crust of Enceladus may provide a habitable environment for life. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Well, new research provides some good news for coffee drinkers. The study of nearly 500,000 British adults shows it may boost chances for a longer life, even for those who down at least 8 cups a day. The apparent longevity boost echoes U.S. research. Overall, drinkers were about 10 to 15% less likely to die than abstainers during a decade of follow-up. Differences by amount of coffee consumed and genetic variations were minimal. Alice Lichtenstein, a Tufts University nutrition expert, was not involved in the research, but she says the results reinforce previous research and add additional reassurance for coffee drinkers.
Where we seem to always be looking for something that's wrong with coffee or bad with coffee, these investigators looked at a very large sample size, and what they concluded was actually that coffee was associated with better health outcomes, that this benefit seemed to be independent of caffeine because it didn't matter whether people consumed regular coffee or decaffeinated coffee.
Well, the results don't prove your coffee pot is a fountain of youth, but they are a reason for abstainers to start drinking coffee.
40 cups of coffee. 40 cups of coffee waiting for you to come home.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, John Ellison. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
40 cups of coffee waiting for you to come home. A quarter to three, I start watching the clock. The phone won't ring, so I'm waiting for your knock. I drink 40 cups of coffee. 40 cups of coffee. 40 cups of coffee waiting for you to come
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The terrorist group ISIS is no longer the threat it used to be. Though it may be diminished, ISIS is far from defeated. As it loses ground in the Middle East, its fighters disperse to cause trouble all over the world, particularly in Muslim countries. ISIS has not limited itself to Iraq and Syria, and therefore neither have we, said Special Presidential Envoy for the Global Coalition to Defeat ISIS, Brett McGurk, at a recent coalition meeting. This meeting itself is an indication of our ongoing commitment to finish the job in Iraq and Syria and ensure that ISIS cannot regenerate elsewhere, particularly on the African continent. In Syria, ISIS retains just 2% of the territory it once held. At that time, nearly 7.7 million people were living under ISIS. They were generating about $1 billion every year, and their expansion looked to be unchecked, said Special Envoy McGurk. And on May 1st, Syrian Democratic Forces resumed offensive operations against those last bits of territory. They are ensuring that ISIS remnants have no escape as we accelerate operations into these remaining strongholds. In Iraq, the fight is over, but the ISIS threat remains. Here, too, stabilization is the key. To date, nearly 4 million displaced Iraqis have returned to their homes in areas that were once held by ISIS. Nonetheless, stabilization projects must continue so that the 2 million Iraqis who are still displaced can return home. Finally, in Africa, the coalition is working with partners to support their efforts to deny space to ISIS and other extremist groups. The coalition will continue to work to close their facilitation networks and transit routes running through Libya, Sudan, and the Maghreb. We are committed not to quick wins, but to the enduring defeat of ISIS. An enduring defeat means more than simply the collapse of the so-called caliphate in Iraq and Syria. It means a holistic defeat in the ideological and media space, combating foreign fighters as they move around the globe, uprooting financial networks, and supporting local forces, military and police, to defend their homelands, said Special Envoy McGurk. We are as proud as we can be of the successes in Iraq and Syria.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.